Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Wade, on behalf of Monty Lean, who's with us here in the courtroom, along with my associate Jessica Krieger and our co-counsel Robert Wayne. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes if I could, Your Honor. Okay. Your Honors, this case picks up where your recent case of Bellevue Farm Owners Association versus Stevens left off. In that particular case, the privilege issue was whether a waiver occurred relative to the attorney billing records and a couple of spreadsheets relative to those billing records, and whether those documents were discoverable in a case in which fees were claimed as damages. You held that waiver applied to the attorney fee and cost billing records that were claimed as damages.
Because of the need to establish or rebut proximate cause.
That's exactly what the court said, yes.
So which way does that cut in this case? Why doesn't that
Well, it's not what we're here about in this case. This case is a legal malpractice case. It's a transactional legal malpractice case, which I believe makes a bit of a difference, in which it arises out of a transaction in which Mr. Lean sold his company, the Designer's Edge, his life's work, to Coleman Cable. And there were problems with the transactional documents created by Mr. Defoe and the Lane Powell firm. Those problems led to arbitration, litigation between Coleman Cable and Lean. Lane Powell, as soon as the problem, well, not as soon as the problems, later on, when the problems with the transactional documents led to this downstream litigation, Lane Powell said, oops, we've got a conflict of interest, and withdrew. At that point, and only at that point, Mr. Lean, and I'm using that collectively, Mr. Lean and his company, the downstream company, TDE Inc., retained Burns Keller Cromwell to represent them in that litigation.
Let me jump ahead a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Assuming you go to trial in this matter and you prevail on a malpractice claim, how are you going to prove damages?
We will prove that with the invoices, the billing records, all of which has been produced. Now, let me be really clear about this. We've produced tens of thousands of pages of documents. When we were in front of Judge Heller, he hadn't realized that until oral argument. We produced, and including all of the invoices and billing records.
So on the billing records, let's just talk there. How are you going to distinguish billing records that are related to the malpractice claims versus billing records that aren't related to malpractice claims, if there are any? I don't know. But
the billing records are not related to malpractice
claims. In terms of how are you going to relate billing records from BKC to the damages portion? How are you going to decide which ones are responsibility of Lane Powell?
Because there will be, obviously, testimony. The first thing we don't know is whether they're challenging the reasonableness of those fees. But there are all the pleadings that were filed. All of that's been produced. All of the arbitration documents, all of that's been produced. Everything has been produced except attorney-client communications and attorney work product. Now, that's where the Bellevue case left off. That's where we begin. Because we understood that in these kind of cases, you're always going to have to litigate over the reasonableness of the consequential damages or the mitigation expenses. What you don't have to go into are the thought processes, the strategy decisions of the downstream attorneys who had nothing whatsoever to do.
Don't you have to demonstrate at trial that the damages, for example, mitigation damages, arbitration damage, payments paid, or settlement payments paid, don't you have to demonstrate that they're reasonable?
You have to demonstrate that the client Flint versus Hart, for example, you have to demonstrate that the client took reasonable measures to mitigate their damages, to limit their damages.
What type of evidence do you put on to show that?
You put on the testimony of Mr. Lean about this is what we did, this is the problem. You will have the testimony of the attorneys, this is what we did.
So you're going to call the attorneys from BKC?
If they must testify as to the reasonableness of the fees. And this is a problem that comes up.
Wouldn't that waive privilege right there?
No.
Why not?
No, and the reason if you look at the Pappas case, and I particularly refer the court to pages 6 through 10 of our reply brief, if you look at the Pappas case, the Dana case, the Jacobleff case, the FDIC case, the official case, the First Security case, there is no waiver as to the work product and privilege of the downstream attorney. And here we have a very different situation from even most of those cases. And specifically that this is not a situation where there was a legal malpractice in a litigation matter, and then a new attorney came in to try and save the case. This is a transactional matter where you have a completely separate downstream litigation.
If you're, for example, on the reasonableness of the settlement money, says damages in the malpractice case.
Yes.
If you're coming in to say, hey, that was a reasonable settlement, but in fact there is, hypothetically, a document out there which includes the analysis by BKC of the theories, and what if part of that analysis is just flat wrong, and that was the premise upon which they arrived at the settlement number? Isn't an issue on proximate cause that Lane Powell should be able to explore?
Lane Powell can have its own expert.
But how are they going to have that? If you got the wrong theory. BKC, you were dead wrong.
If BKC was dead wrong, that's going to be reflected in the pleading.
How are they going to know? How are they going to know the strategy in the mediation was wrong?
Because it will be reflected in the pleadings and other documents. I wanted to make one point, and if you need to take a minute out of my time on rebuttal, that's fine. During the arguments in front of the commissioner, Your Honor, I posed a challenge to opposing counsel. Now, that was a long time ago. They've had plenty of time to think about this. They didn't respond before the commissioner. The question I would like them to answer is, under their formulation, what are the limits of waiver vis-a-vis this downstream counsel, if you were to affirm the trial court ruling and adopt their position? Or stated another way, what Burns Keller Cromwell documents would not relate to the ABC rule under the formulation of the trial court and the Lane Powell firm? The current ruling admits of no limitation whatsoever. And based upon the case law, I think that's indefensible. Thank you, Your Honors.
Yep.
Good morning, Your Honors. Malika Eaton here on behalf of Lane Powell and Brian Defoe. And as an initial matter, I'm glad to answer any questions the panel has. I think what is most notable about what we just heard from opposing counsel is the total lack of analysis of what the trial court here actually did. Because, of course, this court is one step removed. Judge Heller in this case had heard significant summary judgment motions, had heard other motions from the parties. He was close to the facts of this case. He knew the issues in great detail, and he is the only non-interested person to have looked at these documents, examined them in camera, as this court asks judges to do, and determined that they should be disclosed to Lane Powell to allow Lane Powell to defend itself. And Your Honor's question about Bellevue Farms was exactly right. You've recently ruled in that case that issues of causation are exactly the kinds of issues that allow for a waiver in a case like this. And when opposing counsel stood up here and talked about these issues, he didn't talk about the fact that both sides in the briefing before the trial court analyzed the correct standard. The trial court then hurled oral argument in which, again, the correct standard was discussed. And what they're asking you to presume is the complete opposite of what this court normally must presume and should presume here, that the trial court got the standard wrong. There's simply no evidence in the record to support that. They claim in their brief, for example, that the trial court used a mere relevancy standard. There's no evidence of that in the record. They claim in their brief that the trial court issued a rule that the mere filing of the complaint, this is in their reply at page 5, the mere filing of the complaint meant that there was a waiver. There's no evidence in the record to support that the trial court did any such thing.
What is the underlying matter, though, when we look at the rule in these cases? What's the underlying? The malpractice allegation is the transaction was screwed up, not Lane Powell dropped the ball in the preliminary response to this indemnification claims, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think that's why context in these cases is important, and why when you look at the three-part test that you're supposed to be evaluating about whether a waiver has applied, you have to look at it in context. So, for example, and I think my opposing counsel agrees, in Dana and in Pappas, the allegations that were sort of bringing rise to the waiver claim were that another lawyer had actually participated in or contributed to the malpractice. So in those cases, although they reached different results, they were doing the same analysis. And in this case, that's not the same fact pattern we have here. What we have here and what the trial court absolutely understood, because it was discussed in detail in the briefs and at oral argument, was that the issues that the documents in this case go to are issues of causation and are issues related to whether they can establish the requirements of the ABC rule, which opposing counsel barely mentioned, but which the trial court relied on in great detail. And if you have the trial court...
So what malpractice claim that has a claim for damages based on litigation that was required or someone was involved in, that's always going to trigger a waiver because causation for the cost of that litigation is arguably, hypothetically, going to be at issue?
I disagree, Your Honor, and for two reasons. So first of all, in this case, we have a pretty unique fact pattern. We've gone through extensive discovery. Both of the parties have been deposed. We flew to Chicago to depose the Coleman Cable people all before this issue came up. And our summary judgment motion was denied on this specific reason, that we still had, after all this discovery, disputed issues of fact about whether or not Mr. Lean was, in this subsequent litigation, was at all involved. Because remember, under the Jane case, applying the ABC rule, unless Mr. Lean can show that he is blameless in this future litigation with Coleman Cable, the ABC rule elements aren't satisfied. Counsel just stood up in front of you just now and said the problems that they allege occurred in the transactional documents are what led to the litigation between Coleman and Lean. That is a disputed fact.
Can I answer the question that Judge Varellin posed to opposing counsel, which is if the question is one of strategy, I guess, I mean, why is it not a sufficient answer to say, as counsel did, that, well, you can hire your own expert and attack it that way?
For precisely the reason that Judge Varellin pointed out, in these documents, I mean, I'm somewhat at a disadvantage because I haven't seen them. The trial court did and reviewed them carefully. But in these documents, let's just say that Burns Keller says, you know, Mr. Lean, you know that the reason that you're in this is because of stuff that you did. Or let's just say that there's an analysis in there that shows that the amount that ultimately the case was resolved for relates to other factors besides what Lane Powell did. That goes to causation, and that goes to the ABC rule, both of which they put at issue in this case. So those are precisely the sort of issues that we should be allowed, because remember, the plaintiffs and the trial court have said that it is still an issue of disputed material fact as to whether the ABC rule is satisfied, whether causation has been satisfied. After we've
and
done all
and it's because of that one element of the ABC rule that the person has to be blameless?
Correct, Your Honor, because I don't think there's any real dispute over the other aspects of the ABC rule. The other aspects basically relate to, you know, which parties are in what relationship to each other. But the real issue in this case is why, what was really going on between Coleman and Lien that underlay this lawsuit? And what can Mr. Lien actually claim he was blameless? Now, we moved for summary judgment because we thought we had enough to say his claim was defeated on that ground. But the court disagreed and denied our summary judgment motion because there was enough dispute of material fact. That makes this information vital. It makes it of substantial need because we've already deposed Lien. We've already deposed Coleman. We have gone and sort of gone at the well as far as we can, and this is the stuff that we still need. And remember, the trial court was very familiar with this and reviewed these records. I mean, he bent over backwards. Quite frankly, you rarely see trial courts order oral argument on discovery motions. But he was careful with this. He wanted to make sure that he got it right. He called the parties in so that he could push on these issues. And if you read the record of proceedings, he knew exactly what standard he was applying. And their claim is basically that he got the standard wrong. That's how they try to get you to do de novo review. It's not de novo review. He got the standard right, and it's abuse of discretion. And when you're looking through that prism, the court here is the one, the trial court, is the one that knows this case, and after looking at the documents, determined that they should be produced. Counsel challenged us on what are the limits. The trial court set the limits. It's in the order. So if there are documents that are attorney-client privilege that don't go to causation, that don't go to the ABC rule, you know, let's say they're talking about something else, the trial court said you don't have to produce them, but put them on a detailed privilege log so that we can make sure that it's being done right. So in terms of setting the limits, again, I don't have access to the documents. I've never seen them. But I would rely on what the trial court did here, which is determine that these were documents that needed to be produced in order for Lien Powell to actually defend itself.
Dana seems to draw a line between claims for damages and claims that are more related to the transactional malpractice. You seem in your materials to distinguish Dana in part on the grounds that you have this allegation in the malpractice complaint that you were drawn into this allegation that were drawn into this litigation under the ABC rule. How does that make a difference in the fundamental decision in Dana?
Yeah, I think if you actually take a careful look at the facts of Dana, it's interesting because in Dana, the complaint in Dana didn't mention the subsequent litigation at all. So that is certainly a distinguishing feature. Here, Mr. Lien made an affirmative choice to make it a central feature. And in fact, it accounts for over $1 million of his damages, more than 50%. But when you look at how the waiver issue came up in Dana, I think that's where you really see the distinctions between Dana and this case. And if you look at the analysis in Dana, the Dana court showed that it was the answer of the defending attorney that made a reference to, well, you know, I think other people advised on the transaction. And of course, so the trial court, when the trial court examined that issue and this court examined that issue, they really challenged that and said, you can't possibly have substantial need and this can't be vital because the attorneys that you're talking about only post-dated the transaction. And so then what you saw in Dana is, and if Your Honor, if I could just finish this one point, what you saw in Dana is that the trial court and the requesting party shifted their reasons to then say, oh, well, it goes to the reasonableness of the settlement. And although sometimes you're still allowed privileged information for that analysis, the prerequisites were not met in that case. So the reason for the need was very different in Dana. With that, we would ask that the court affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Two minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with this. Representation was made. We had this summary judgment motion, and Judge Heller heard this, and Judge Heller ruled that the genuine – Judge Heller, as I recall, did not hear that motion. This case was initially in front of Judge North, as I recall. Now, I may be mistaken. I'm getting up there in years, and if my memory fails me, I apologize. But I believe that was Judge North. We were subsequently transferred to Judge Heller. They have not deposed the Burns, Keller, Cromwell attorneys, and they have not identified any expert to testify that Burns, Keller, Cromwell in any way mishandled the case. There's no allegation of that. Or to challenge the reasonableness of the Burns, Keller, Cromwell fees, or to suggest that anything that the client did in the downstream litigation was in any way unreasonable, that he was making unreasonable choices. None of that has been raised. That's their burden. That's their burden. Now, what do they want? They want, and if you look at page 9 of the verbatim report of proceedings, they want, and continuing on page 10 onto page 11, they want everything.
Court didn't give them everything.
I don't know what the court gave them, to tell you the truth. If you can tell me what we're supposed to produce based on that order, I'd appreciate the clarification, because we've seen the documents, and we don't know what we're required to do. And that's part of the problem here, because there is no standard established as to what's relevant and what, not just relevant, what's where there's waiver and where there isn't. So we need some sort of bright line rule that tells us what we can do, because obviously we don't want to defy courts. So thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you both. Next up is Mock versus Department of Corrections.